Jim Poppy moves the minutes. Approval of the minutes of March 16th. Any additions or corrections? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. First up is House File 2536. Representative Powers, remove your...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I believe, you, Mr. Chairman, there's an amendment that you'll need to move for me, be a delete all amendment.
Do you want
and it's marked H2356DE1.
Okay, and where is this bill? Is this going?
Mr. Chairman, this bill would be laid over for consideration in the Environment Finance Omnibus Bill.
Okay, I'll move House File 2356. I recommend to be included in the Omnibus Bill. I'll also move the DE1 amendment to 2356 to get the bill into the order that the author desires. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have today with me Ms. Paula West, who is the Executive Director of Minnesota Lakes Association, and she will briefly explain the bill and why we brought it forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The Minnesota Lakes Association represents about 60,000 lakeshore property owners and users, 15 county coalitions of lake associations, and over 250 lake associations in Minnesota. All of these members are concerned about the future quality of Minnesota's lakes, as I'm sure all of you are as well. We are here today to ask for an amendment to collect the 1.54% of the unrefunded gas tax that is due to motorboat usage. Currently, 1.5% is being collected, but the formula that was determined in 1987 and then again reaffirmed in 1998, we feel it is okay as it is, but we would like to see the full amount of the formula determined be collected. That extra $300,000 that it would be accounted for in the 0.04% that's not collected now, we would like to see go into a cost share grant program for local governments or qualified lake management organizations for exotic species management. We're also asking for a study of the current allocation of the water rec account, at least the portion of it that is related to the motorboat unrefunded gas tax, to try to carve out of there a cost share lakes grant program similar to the $3.2 million grant program that Wisconsin very successfully has right now. I'd like to tell you a little bit about why we're asking for this. Lakes are Minnesota's greatest natural assets for our recreation, our quality of life, and our economics. I doubt that there's anybody in this room that doesn't have fond memories of some lake in Minnesota. And though we don't have an official study in Minnesota of the economic value of lakes to Minnesota, I have a few points I'd just like you to ponder related to the economics. The assessed waterfront property values in Wisconsin are $170 billion, and 80% of their lakes are under 10 acres in size. Minnesota has far more surface water acres developed than Wisconsin does, and so our waterfront property is probably exceeds $170 billion. Water clarity and water property values are tied together. A recent study at Bemidji State of 137 lakes in the upper Mississippi watershed basin showed that millions of dollars would be lost if there was only a slight decrease in water quality. For instance, if only the water quality in Leech Lake decreased by only 3 feet, the decrease in property values would be $131 million. Tourism is one of the largest industries in Minnesota, largely dependent upon clean lakes. And in the five-county Central Lakes region of Minnesota, tourism brings in excess of $500 million a year. And at $7 a pound in the retail market for walleye, the 35 million pounds of walleye that were harvested out of Minnesota's lakes in 2002 would be a retail value of $245 million. Indeed, lakes are not only important to us recreationally, but they are important to this state economically. But Minnesota's lakes are in jeopardy from overuse, overdevelopment, exotic species, and non-point source pollution, to the point that our children and our grandchildren may not be able to enjoy them the same way that we do today. Over 100 lakes are on the impaired waters list because of nutrient impairment, but we have 11,700 other lakes in Minnesota over 10 acres in size that we need to protect from impairment. Eurasian water milfoil has increased 50% over the last 5 years. We now have 152 lakes in Minnesota that are infested with the exotic species Eurasian water milfoil. We have 500 lakes in Minnesota that are infested with curly leaf pondweed, which is another exotic plant that is becoming a new problem. We have zebra mussels now found in the prime tourist area of Minnesota. And these exotic species threaten the diversity and the abundance of our native plant communities, which are important to the ecosystem and fish habitat, and they affect our economy and our recreational abilities. And lakeshore development is threatening the quality of our lakes and pushing the price of lakeshore to the point where most Minnesotans cannot afford to buy lakeshore anymore. Who are the real managers of Minnesota's waters? We would contend that it is Minnesota's citizens and local governments.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
This amendment has significantly changed this bill. It sent it in a whole different direction. I have not consulted on this. I haven't any idea what the impacts are or what other committees may like to see this bill. So I'd like to lay House File 2356 over for us to kind of examine to see as to whether this should have a hearing before this committee this year.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
House File 2356 is laid over. Representative Howes, do you have anything else that you haven't completely changed?
Mr. Chairman, are you talking on my next bill?
Yes. If we're wondering as to what that's going to look like.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there are people requesting changes. I have not changed, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Was there anyone else that you had in here to speak on 2356 that we just laid over?
No.
Because it has significantly changed, and I have no way of knowing as to how we should be handling that. I like to prepare myself to be able to advise my committee on how to deal with an issue. And to change it from a study to a bill that's asking for a grant program and increasing the amount of money that's coming from the gasoline tax, I think that's a significant change. Representative Cornish.
Yeah, I had the same. I was looking up the statute now, and some of this money goes to enforcement and all sorts of things in the regular water rec account, and this would change the direction of all additional money over the 1.5, so I had the same concerns.
Yeah, before you make that kind of a change, can you try and give us a little heads up on that? That's can't quite move that fast around here. Let's see. Representative Howes, House File 2334.
Mr. Chairman, I believe this would go to the General Register.
Representative Howes, I'll move House Bill 2334. And what is the, do you have an amendment that you want for this?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I do have an oral amendment on page 25.
Okay.
Would like to delete lines 30 and 31.
The effective date?
Yes, and then the information that I've been given, then the effective date would be August 1st.
Okay. Mr. Chair, what page was that? I'm sorry.
Page 25. And it's deleting lines 30-31, which is essentially the effective date, just moves it back a month. All those in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Bill is amended. Representative House.
Mr. Chairman, House File 2334 is actually many bills combined into one. It's had a long journey. We started out originally with a bill that Representative Pennis had, which was House File 2218. We added several land exchanges, different members, Dill, Solberg, Pennis, Smith, and Walls, have been added to this bill. All of those were approved by the DNR and the subcommittee. Since then, I believe there are one or two that have been added, and those were also approved by the DNR. Representative Pennis's bill was basically, that we added land exchanges to, was Department of Natural Resources Surplus Land Bill. This bill has been in front of this, in front of all of you, I believe, if you're all on environment policy. It talks about the Concon lands in Beltrami County, where they're part of an airport project, and they would like a small parcel to be deemed appropriate for part of that airport. There's some lands being deleted from the George Washington State Forest, Itasca County, which are less than an acre in size, and they make more sense and better management practices to do that. Also, there's some Concon land in Lake of the Woods County, known as the Potomo Cemetery, and that it's been determined that that would be better served in the private entity. That and then my bill that... give me a moment here, Mr. Chairman, because we've added so many things to different portions of this bill that I'm trying to keep track myself. My bill would be the surplus state land sale disposition and management provisions. And we've done some things in this bill. The bill's been prepared in conjunction with the Department of Administration. And what we're doing is the DNR land sale authorities, which are in chapters 92 and 94, the Department of Administration's land sale authority is intertwined with the DNR in chapter 94. And we're streamlining this. There are some technical, several technical adjustments throughout the bill that we certainly could get more into in this committee again, but we have done it in environment policy. And I've been told, Mr. Chairman, that there are several different members that have amendments to the Omnibus Lands Bill. I've also been told that I believe you have all those amendments. They have all been approved by the DNR. And if you would, the chairman would like, we could bring those amendments up and add them to the bill and then bring some staff up if you would like to interrogate this member on the Omnibus Lands Bill.
Okay. I have one amendment here. It's 1112 from Chisago County.
Mr. Chairman, that would be Representative Pete Nelson. And if Kathy Lewis from the DNR could come up here, she could verify that these different amendments have been approved by the DNR.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Kathy Lewis with the Department of Natural Resources. And Amendment 804-1112 has a provision for Chisago County and also for Rock County. And both of those proposed sales have been approved by the Department of Natural Resources.
Okay. I'll move the 1112 amendment. Are there any questions on the amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Bill is amended.
Mr. Chairman, that amendment did take care of two, and I'm just trying to track through my information that I was handed this morning. Your excellent staff, Ms. Brick, would probably know if I've missed one.
I have one in front of me that says up in the top, DNR Lands and Minerals. It's evidently a Representative Magnus amendment.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Lewis just told me that the amendment adopted included the amendment from Representative Magnus.
We have County State Care. This is in there too. All right, that's been taken care of. Anything else?
Mr. Chairman, the amendment at the top is marked DNR landscape. I've just been told does have to be added to also. And Ms. Lewis would like to explain it.
If you'd like to address the committee, please identify yourself for the record.
Gloria Johnson, Division of Lands and Minerals, Department of Natural Resources. When our regional staff reviewed the proposed land sale in Rock County, they felt that it would be more appropriate to have a deed restriction to prevent any tillage or building construction on the property and grazing limits. We worked with the county yesterday, and we got the county's agreement to this amendment language. And the justification for it is that the Topeka Shiner, which is a federally endangered minnow, and is restricted in the Minnesota Missouri River drainage, it's felt that the deed restrictions would allow the private ownership and use of the parcel, but still provide safeguards to protect water quality. And that would, again, favor survival of the endangered species.
Okay.
The county, to my knowledge, is in agreement with it. I do have a letter from the county agreeing to the language.
Okay. The amendment that we're referring to is says up on the top, DNR Lands and Minerals, and it is starts off with Representative Doug Magnus. So we'll be actually on line two of this amendment. First of all, I'll move that amendment, but we need to change to adapt to the amendment that we just adopted, and so we'll change it to where on line two it'll be after line 19 instead of 12. Page three, the new paragraph will read, and so in the amendment that we just adopted, the 11-12 amendment, if you go to page three and line 19, that's where this new paragraph will be inserted. Are there any questions on the amendment? Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, then this only applies to this tract of land, nothing statewide implications then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, that is correct.
All right. Any other? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could either the author or Representative Magnus or somebody explain to me a little bit what's going on with this parcel? I'm not following. We're talking about not tilling to not building a building. I'd like a little background of what's going on here.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Magnus?
Representative McNamara, as I understand this 11-acre parcel is bordered by a private landowner who had parceled this out and sold it to an individual who allowed it to go tax forfeited. The person who is interested in purchasing this is the previous landowner. And as I understand, the tract has been pastured for many years and is currently not under cultivation.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to say a big thank you to Ms. Johnson with the department. It's done a great job. I only got this information late last week, and we've been scrambling hard to get the DNR out there to look at this, and they have, and I appreciate that very much, and just gets a mess cleaned up there for us.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, on the amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion prevails. That was amended. Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for your indulgence, and I was as surprised as you were that there were amendments this morning. And I believe the bill is now in the shape that we would all like it to be in, and I'd stand for questions.
Okay. For some houses, I understand the bill really doesn't have any fiscal impact. It just it is changing some ways that we do business in the state of Minnesota, and that's what was actually explained before the policy committee. So.
Correct.
Even though it has, it deals with fiscal issues, it doesn't have a fiscal impact. Are there any questions on the bill, Representative Wagenius?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative House, there are several bills that come through the legislature, like the revisers bill and the lands bill, where those of us who are not involved put all of our confidence in the author. In your judgment, is this good bill, good public policy?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, yes, I believe it is.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, the motion to approve House File, recommend that House File 2334 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. House File 2660, Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If the chairman would be so kind to move that bill, and I believe, would this go to the General Register? Or are you...
This would be laid over for the honor of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
House File, we'll move House File 2660 for consideration. Be included in the omnibus bill. Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I think I'll have Mr. Tomlinson first describe the bill and what we're doing here. And I believe he's the only one that's going to speak at this point, but we do have another witness who would like to testify. Probably two. I think Ms. Brick has a list that would testify on the bill in favor of it, and then we'd stand for questions. So if you'd like to give it to Mr. Tomlinson, Mr. Chairman, that would be appreciated.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to present House File 2660 to you this morning. Basically, what House File 2660 is, we testified in policy committee last week, but it does two things that were included in the as part of a list of items that came out of the governor's industry competitiveness study and were made as recommendations back to the governor. This bill does two of those items. First off, it creates a forest management investment fund where it has dedicated dollars come back to the DNR, not as general fund, but then as dedicated funds, and I'll talk more about that in a moment. And the second thing that it does, it provides for additional funding necessary to put more people in the woods in order to do more forest management work, and we'll get into that in a little bit more detail as well. Those are two of the key items that came out of the governor's industry competitiveness study. Essentially, I'll quickly first go through the bill. Just Section 1 deals with exchange of funds out of the CONCON. About 50% of all the revenues that come off the CONCON lands for timber sales are returned to the counties, and we're proposing that the balance of that would otherwise go to the general fund be now deposited into the Forest Management Investment Fund, the new dedicated fund that this bill would establish. The Section 2 pertains to that part that related to the acquired lands, and all of the revenues that come off of acquired lands that timber sale receipts currently go into the general fund. We're proposing that all of those revenues in the future going through the Forest Management Investment Fund. Section 3 essentially creates the Forest Management Investment Fund and lists out some general purposes for that, following that. And Section 4, which I'll ask Joe Kersenka to speak to in a moment, basically sets up the financial changes that are necessary to create the fund in the budget document. If you could just turn your attention to the fact sheet that we just handed out, and this is one that we put together before last committee's hearing, the front side at the policy committee hearing, and that hasn't changed. We have added some information on the back, and I'll just explain that in a moment. But basically, the purpose for the Forest Management Investment Fund is fairly well laid out there, I think, on top of that. We provide some minimal level of stability and reliability and funding for basic forest management practices, better diversified forest management program funding within the DNR, provide an ability to carry fund balances between bienniums, which is very important to us, given the seasonal nature of forest management expenditures and the long-term nature of those investments. And lastly, this would also provide the ability to fund additional field forester positions for timber stand improvement and inventory updates. As I mentioned, it lays out below, there's three paragraphs here, that timber sale receipts off of acquired lands. I should mention that in fiscal year 03, the total timber sale receipts were about $18.6 million, a little beyond that. The timber sale receipts off of acquired lands amounted to $3.6 million, and the timber sale receipts, the 50% of the receipts going into the general fund off of Concon lands amounted to about $2 million. Those are the two items there that we are proposing be deposited into the newly established Forest Investment Fund for a total of $5.6 million. There, I want to emphasize there's two main points on this. One is that we feel this is entirely budget neutral. It should have no impact on the general fund. In actuality, in out years, it might have a positive benefit on the general fund, and but has no negative impact early on. And the other thing is that we are not doing anything relative to the trust fund lands, which, of course, is a great interest for a lot of folks in protecting the forest expense account and otherwise. So those are two points that I'd like to make with that. But that I the back side of the sheet just basically shows the relationship, if you will, of this request, which should basically be on the left, with the bonding request, which we've made as well on the right. And we want to emphasize this isn't necessarily to accelerate, to do a lot more than what we're currently doing without the bonding levels and stuff, but it would get to those purposes that we're looking for on the that I mentioned previously. With that, I guess maybe I'll let Joel talk to the financial end of it in a second.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Joe Kersink. I'm with the Department of Natural Resources, its Office of Management and Budget. From a financial perspective, there were two principal goals. One was to be budget neutral to the general fund, and the second was to fund a timber management initiative to the amount of $600,000 per year. If you look down at line 32, you'll see that the net result of that is an increase of $600,000 to the overall forest appropriation. If you look at line 34 in 05, there is a reduction of $5.615 million, and that is a reduction to the general fund direct appropriation available to forestry, which is a match to the $5.615 million that's in our February forecast. We're predicting that would be the timber sale receipts that would be made available to the general fund. So we've made that budget neutral to the general fund. On page 3, there's an appropriation from the Forest Management Investment Fund of $6.215 million. That's simply the 5.615 plus the 600,000. In down on lines 55, it just talks that the 6215 is available for the purposes specified for the fund. And then in line 60, the additional $600,000 per year, we talk about where does that come from initially. In the first year, that will come from the forest nursery account. We intend to borrow $600,000 from the balance that is currently available in the forest nursery account, and then to pay that back by 2012. I think that explains, at least initially, the financial piece.
Are there any questions? Mr. Wagenius.
Thank you. Not so much a question, Mr. Chairman. I think creating the account is a good idea. But I still remain concerned that we purchase seedlings, and this the rider language in this is, does get into the seedling account, that we purchase seedlings from outside the state. And I think as a matter of Minnesota policy, we should buy Minnesota grown, both to encourage our local private nurseries and to make sure that DNR has enough of its own seedlings. When we import, we are more likely to import a pest that we don't want. And this committee has become acutely aware of pests of all sorts, whether they're funguses or huge carp. Did you also get in the paper this morning about carp, by the way? But anyway, that's an article worth reading. I think we should, as a matter of policy, have a piece of rider language in here that says that we expect DNR to purchase Minnesota grown stuff. And that's probably not a statutory appropriate thing, but we have rider language here. And I would hope that you would consider that.
Thomason, what's the practice with DNR and purchasing your stock?
Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, I'd like Director Mike Carroll to speak to this, given that he's got his former nursery experience and knows much better. Perhaps.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Mike Carroll. I'm the director of the Division of Forestry. For 8 years, I ran the State Forest Nursery Program as a member and chairman of the Northeastern Area Nursery Association. I worked very closely with the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association, which one of your members used to be very actively with. And as you know, Mr. Chairman, we've worked very cooperatively. Your concern is very legitimate, and it is the policy of the State Forest Nursery. The priority one is Minnesota-grown, Minnesota seed source products. That's priority number one. The availability has not been there. So what we have done is with cooperative agreements, we also purchase from the private sector. And when we purchase from the private sector or when we exchange seedlings with adjacent states, they must be certified in the same seed zone. Materials we receive from the state of Wisconsin, for example, are from the St. Croix seed source zone, which does cross the borders of the nursery. In the White Pine Initiative, we actually did bring in screened sources from Michigan and other parts of the country that were part of the blister rust resistant program that was developed there. Also had to do with some screening for global warming and those types of things, genetic seed sources that would be more viable in a warming climate. So we have a priority of Minnesota-grown, Minnesota seed source. When that is not available, the second step is adjacent state or continuous landform seed sources, which we purchase. We also purchase, for example, private sector stock that is Minnesota seed source but grown in other states. We also share your concern on the pathogens. Minnesota nurseries are luckily not infected with certain root pathogens that occur in other parts of the state, so whenever we purchase from outstate, they are handled in sanitary situations off of our nursery sites so we don't gain those pathogens in the state. That's our answer. We have not been able to say Minnesota purchase, Minnesota only, through the contracting portions of the existing state. One of the concerns that the private sector has, we do not produce container stock, but we do write specifications for container stock, and right now Canadian nurseries are out-competing local Minnesota nurseries on those production of that stock. Now, that's Minnesota seeds provided. That is Minnesota genetics provided to producers. So that's where we are in the process. We support the concept Minnesota-grown, Minnesota seed source. We are very careful not to bring pathogens into ours or our private cooperator nurseries.
Unfortunately, when we become dependent on somebody else, then we run two risks, that they won't be grown here because we're dependent on somebody else and we can bring in a soil pathogen. It seems to me that we need to review the policy of saying that we can only have a certain number of DNR-grown seedlings
if there are seedlings available from Minnesota growers, wonderful. But going out to Michigan and having to worry about having sterile soil, etc., doesn't seem to me to be in Minnesota's best interest. It seems to me that where we don't have enough, you know, we have to go out by beyond the whatever limit you have, 10,000?
The state forest nursery production is capped at 10 million.
10 million? What? Once we go out beyond that and cannot purchase Minnesota grown, it seems to me we should go back to DNR and have it grown here. I just am so worried about what we can be bringing in from other states, people who won't be as concerned about us as we are. I have no questions about Minnesota nurseries. Their vested interest is so high in being clean. But I am really not happy with purchases from outside the state. Even if we use Minnesota seed all the time, we should be using Minnesota seed grown in Minnesota and creating jobs in Minnesota, whether they're DNR jobs or private jobs. This using this fund to send money to Michigan does not warm my heart. Creating the fund is a good idea, but that's not where I want to send my money.
We are in agreement, and we're trying to work very cooperatively with the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association to build that capacity in the private sector.
But if our private sector doesn't have the stock, and if they just choose not to do it for whatever reasons, it seems to me that under that circumstance, we ought to lift the limit on what DNR can do. I'd love to encourage Minnesota grown nurseries, but once we have reached that, exporting our dollars to import possible pathogens is not smart. So that's the issue, I think, Mr. Chairman, if we could have some more conversation about and put a rider in.
Cheryl? We agree with the concept, and I do want to say that the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association has been very proactive in attempting to build capacity, and they're trying to do that. The challenge for the private sector, and this is from having run a public sector nursery, and I have a small private concern in Missouri, so I understand the business on both ends of it, the margin of return for cost share materials is very small. So the capacity building that occurs in much of the private sector is on larger return, larger margin return materials, not in the conservation grade materials that are there. We're in agreement that the Nursing Landscape Association has given us a variance under the direction of this committee, because we have to be very careful that we don't talk about market and price, because that's gets to be trust violation, because we've been in, as a state, we've been in the market for many years. So we've worked very closely with them. I just want to say we are in agreement that the priority is to build capacity here in Minnesota.
Okay, but I want to take it the next step, and that is if in any given year there isn't capacity in Minnesota nurseries, then we should not be exporting our dollars and possibly importing pathogens. We should say then, DNR, you do more of the seedlings. That is where I think that we have to take that is the next step. It's not one-step process, it's a two-step process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Carroll, could you just give the committee a little background and actually why we had to reach out to Wisconsin and purchase the red pine that was actually a disease problem
in
the state nursery? And if I'm not mistaken, if it wouldn't have been for the unusual disease problem within our own nursery and your positive efforts to make sure that we didn't use the disease stock that was growing within our own state, we had to reach out to other states to purchase this stock. And if I'm not mistaken, wasn't it purchased bare root, so we weren't importing soil with these seedlings. And we would not have reached out to the other states without the disease problem that happened in our own nursery.
The past history is that it's an excellent question, and I want to frame it in that the need for conservation-grade seedlings is periodic and fluctuates based on cost-share programs and how many people want to plant trees. We have had a past history, even with state uncapped state production, there have been periods of time when there haven't been enough seedlings available in the state to meet the cost-share programs, because you have to make a three-year planting investment to have the seedling come out the other end, and the cost-share programs have fluctuated sometimes in a 6 to 8 month period. So it's difficult to plan on it. What Representative McNamara is referring to is over the past 2 years, not just in the state nurseries but in other production, because of our weather changes again and because of a pathogen that previously had not been detected in nurseries in the state, and we weren't alone. It occurred in Wisconsin and other states. Because of our weather changes, our open winters, we did have a pathogen affect our red pine stock in the state forest nursery. So we did cooperatively work with the private sector and seek out competent seed sources, pest-free, certified pest-free stock to meet that shortfall. So that is what and it was a very positive, cooperative effort to do that. In the future, as additional needs are there, we have not purchased stock from Michigan because, as you know, we had problems with gypsy moth and other materials, so we have not purchased from certain growers. Unless the growers in Wisconsin, some of them private, some of them state, or in North and South Dakota, which are soil and water conservation district nurseries, unless those are certified pest-free and then inspected, spot-inspected by our forest health people, we do not accept them in the state. And we have had shortfalls in some cost-share programs because they haven't been enough seedlings. Did I answer your question, Representative?
Well, the only follow-up I would have, Director Carroll, if you could, like, what was the actual quantities purchased from Wisconsin, and what was the quantity lost in the disease in our own nursery?
We're talking 2 to 3 million seedlings that were lost on an annual basis. Yeah. And cumulatively over a two-year period, we lost up to 5 million seedlings from the disease.
And a follow-up, how many were bought from the state nursery in Wisconsin?
The state nursery in Wisconsin gave us anywhere from 2 to 3 million seedlings. Some of them weren't all, they weren't all red pine. Some of them were white pine.
So, Mr. Chair and Director Carroll, if I could quick follow-up, you did adequate planning to try, and I know it fluctuates up and down, as you said. I mean, we got $3 million in bonding that you don't know if you're going to get or not, so I'd
Correct.
Like to know how you're going to plan for these seedlings that we planted 3 years ago that we don't even know if we're going to need next year. So
I have an answer to that question.
Well, you and I probably have the same answer. But along those lines, if not for the devastation of the disease, and which was a lot of it by weather,
Correct.
We would have been in a much better position. And I think you and the industry both should be commended to you're doing a good job. When you do reach out to other areas, that you're careful, and there's a lot of restrictions, members, on bringing plant material in from other states. And I just want to say both the DNR and the Department of Ag and the industry, as Director Carroll knows, I'm a past president of that association you're referring to, have worked jointly very hard to control this, and we want to buy them within the state whenever we can. And things happen beyond our control sometimes that we have to work with. And I think the controls we have there are good, and I certainly would not support raising the limit of the $10 million. I'll have to say that right now. Thank you.
Can I answer the bonding question before he leaves that? We would need those seedlings. We would hope those would be produced by Minnesota container growers, and those can be produced in anywhere from an 8 to a 12-month period. So that's where we're hoping those seedlings will show up from. Minnesota-grown, Minnesota container producers, not out of the state forest nurseries, but out of private entities here in the state of Minnesota.
Chairman, you said something that people, you said you have a part ownership in a nursery in Missouri?
I, in my part time in Missouri, I have a little small private production of seedlings for neighbors that I produce. Since I have been a nursery supervisor, they've asked me to do some custom. I've been asked to sell them on the local market. I said I will not do that until I am a private, retired gentleman in the hills of Missouri. But I do have some nursery production. I fool with pot production. I do some spaded materials for the neighbors at this point in time. But I plan to be rich in the future with that operation.
Okay.
Thank God.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm probably the only person on this committee who's going to vote against this bill. And I do feel, and even I feel somewhat conflicted about it. About 15 years ago, some of us worked incredibly hard to, this used to be a dedicated fund. And some of us worked very, very hard to undedicate a whole bunch of funds and put them into the general fund because that's considered to be a good budget practice. We ended up maybe with about 65 that were undedicated. And the answer is that you can do everything that a dedicated fund does by honest budgeting. You know, you look, you do it at, you can keep the money in a special account without the extra fiscal mess of having to set up a separate fund and manage it and manage a separate fund. You can just watch how much money comes in. You can look at what the needs are and budget that money out. There's much better legislative oversight. The legislature doesn't pay the attention to dedicated funds that it does to general funds. Actually, this project, which had total bipartisan support and which could not be done except with support of the leaders in both houses beyond the beyond just the members of the committee, because we then had to amend the budget resolution because we were putting a lot more money into and out of the general fund. We actually won an honorable mention in the Kennedy School Ford Foundation leadership projects for the year in terms of innovative public policy. Now, the glitches, and that's why I don't feel, you know, I only feel a little bit badly about getting rid of this now, is that depends on honest budgeting, both from the administration and from the department. If you honestly budget and budget according to needs and honestly make sure that the money that you take in goes back out, and then you pay the kind of attention to it. You look and you see if there are costs, if there are cost overruns. You look and see if you're getting the most efficient use of costs. It's just a much better way of budgeting. And the fact that they're coming in and asking for a dedicated fund, and I guess with the blessing of the administration, shows that the administration is saying, tie my hands and keep me from cheating. And essentially, that's what the department is saying. That's what we need. And everyone who's voting for this is essentially saying the same thing, is that only the dedicated funds are safe when you're not budgeting. And I think if we looked at last year's budget, I was too depressed to look at it carefully, but there were lots of places where expenses of boards that used to be paid for by a dedicated fund but are now being paid for a general fund were raided to patch up the general fund. So that people could do, regulatory boards could do less hearings than they needed to do, you know, things like the professional regulatory boards because of that. And I think, you know, unless we decide that we're going to be honest in our budgeting, we're just going to continually go back, back to having dedicated funds, because that's the only way people can see the programs that they want to save. And if it's bad, you know, I could go back those 15 years and get all my arguments out about why we did it. All of the stories, all of the articles from fiscal experts that tell you that you're much better off with general fund appropriations and with the kind of legislative oversight that follows that. There's also another downside. We talked about the fact that we're doing bonding. Well, I don't see one of the allowed things, and maybe we'll fix that up when we at the final point. I don't see one of the things that you're allowed to spend the money on. Well, maybe it's broad enough depending on how you do it, is on, for example, bonding for forest land. Now, as you cut down the budget of the general fund, you cut down the amount of money that's available to back up bonds and either debt service or just to back up the general fund in a fiscally responsible manner. So, you know, one of the things is if we could use this investment fund also for bonding, that would be a much more sensible use of it than taking away general fund dollars that could be used for bonding, just because bonding for anything that has a long lifetime is just a much more fiscally sensible way of funding it. So I'm disappointed. You know, I understand why people are asking for this, and I'm disappointed that they feel that they have to ask for it, and even more disappointed that we're going to feel that we have to give it to them, because it's bad fiscal policy, and it's unnecessary if we had an honest approach to budgeting. Now someone who's going to vote for it can tell me why they voted for it.
Representative Guinea is on the bill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I still remain concerned about importing pathogens accidentally, certainly not on purpose. I trust that we wouldn't do it on purpose. However, there are things we think we know, and we import buckthorn. That was a huge mistake, and we've repeated that mistake again and again because our knowledge was not quite as sophisticated as it needed to be. And in this area, we're still not as sophisticated as as God is, and when he gives us the funguses and the pathogens and all that kind of thing. So, Mr. Chairman, I think that is the downside of what we're doing, and that a rider would be appropriate for Minnesota Grown in the event that there is not enough Minnesota stock, that DNR would go back and use more of its stock.
Representative Guinness, I think that the DNR has testified that that's their practice now, and I have a strong aversion to having the legislature try to micromanage the districts, the departments. I think that they have to be able to make their decisions based upon the judgments. There's all kinds of things that can happen in the forest industry that they may have to react to that we would not be able to undo if we started putting all that into statute, and I think that's the wrong way to manage government, and so I would have to resist your attempts to put a rider in the show.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guinness, I want to assure you, not only because of my own technical background in forest health and in nursery management, and our strong cooperation with the Department of Agriculture and those types of people, that we fully understand our limitations in this area, and it is our priority to have the production here in Minnesota. We are in agreement with that. Conceptually, the practicality of being able to meet those demands is where we have the problem. We will continue to work with the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association to try to increase capacity in the private sector in Minnesota.
President Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a comment for you, Director Carroll, and then another question. And, you know, take this comment with a grain of salt because I'm not an attorney. And I do admire your retirement plan of hot production, but there's a downside there. You could get arrested. But again, I'm not an attorney. Take your risks.
Potted trees. Thank you for that, Claire.
Oh. See, I told you. Do have a serious question. Okay. On page 2, line 26, what are cultural resource reviews?
We have a standing contract with the Archaeological Society in Minnesota that anytime we do a forest management activity, we check the files, the existing files, or if we have an additional concern, we actually have archaeologists come out on the site to take a look at. For example, if we think there's a homestead, or if we know from our cooperation with the tribal entities that there might have been a hunting and gathering area, we actually have a process for our management practices, especially if we're going to do a mechanical site prep or those types of things, where those sites are reviewed based on existing heritage files and then requested site visits at that point in time.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll go to our next testifier, John Curry.
Top of the morning to you, committee. Mr. Chair.
Please identify yourself for the record.
John Curry, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. We come in support of this bill. We think it's a good bill, the right thing to do. And I have some comments to put it in context for the committee. MCEA is one of the seats on the Minnesota Forest Resources Council. We've been there for a number of years, and we've testified in support of the council, in particular, the funding that goes to landscape level analysis.
And this analysis fits in tightly with the goals and objectives of this bill here today. What the Forest Resources Council is doing, in cooperation with the Division of Forestry, I should say, is they have looked at all of our forest types across different land ownership types, whether it's county or state, private forested land, and they've gone to see what that forest would look like in the absence of any human intervention. What did it look like 200 years ago, 500 years ago? And it all depends on the soil type, the weather and climate conditions, the slope of the land, and they're able to look that a forest is never static. It's always changing from an early pioneer species to a later, more standard forest. It will go from aspen to pine species to spruce, and then some event will take place, fire and destruction, disease and rot, and it'll go back through these processes again. But throughout it all, there should be some analysis of what those forest types are. This bill is looking at some of those stands in Minnesota's forests that are not being productive and that are not being, that natural cessation is not happening for any variety of reasons. Earlier in the session, one of our board members, Steve Thorne, testified about bonding reforestation on the North Shore, Representative Dillville. And it's really a similar concept that's taking place here, but it's not along the North Shore in the state parks. It's in other areas of our state forests where the natural cessation of the forest is not taking place for a variety of reasons, and the Division of Forestry has said we will use these monies to go in and do that work. I want to put out one other piece, and that is the funding piece of this. We're most comfortable with the outcomes and operations and the use of this fund, and we have to look twice at the use of dedicating forest timber harvesting revenue to a Division of Forestry practice. And I just want to put a stake in the sand here that we're comfortable if it's a 10 to 20% range that the Division of Forestry is being funded. It's not an absolute position that they can never have any revenue from forest generation. But if this were to get up there into the 70 and 80% range where the division will become dependent upon harvesting, aggressive harvesting perhaps, that's where we begin to become uncomfortable. So I wanted to put that out there and leave my comments in support of the bill.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Boxer, Wagner? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Daryl Wagner. I'm a union work, maintenance worker at the Cascade Pit Mill in International Falls. I'm speaking on behalf of the Wood Fibers Employee Joint Legislative Council. The Wood Fibers Council is an organization representing labor and management at unionized forest product mills in the state. We support House File 2660 and are very glad that Representative House has introduced this bill. We think that using some of the money that the state gets from timber sales to reinvest and the land is important to the long-term health of our forests and our jobs. Last year, loggers and our mills paid the state $20 million for the trees that we harvested from these lands, and yet every year we hear the DNR has a tough time investing back in our lands. By creating this fund, we make sure that at least some funds are going back into our forests every year to make our forests better for the long-term and protect our jobs and the jobs we hope our children have in rural Minnesota. It's our understanding that this bill will not impact the general fund this year. The money from the timber sales will just be place current appropriations. While we understand that it has to be this way because of the budget deficit, we urge the legislature to make sure the DNR has enough money to keep our forests and our jobs strong in the future. Whether the money comes from the Forest Management Investment Fund, the General Fund, or from bond funds, continuous improvement investment in the forest is just as important to continuous investment in our mills. Again, we urge you to support this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Wagner. Appreciate it. Wayne Brandt.
Wayne Brandt, Executive Vice President of Minnesota Forest Industries, Minnesota Timber Producers Association. I did testify in the policy committee, so we would just lend our voice and reiterate the testimony that we made there and our strong support for this initiative. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone that would like to testify for or against the bill? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gary Botzik. I'd like to testify in support of the bill for the Minnesota Conservation Federation. And sorry for the delay, but I wanted to ask Mr. Brandt. Yeah. There is a wildlife seat on the Forest Resource Council, and Sean Parrish is that representative now. Good forest management is good wildlife management, and it's good for deer, it's good for grouse, it's good for all of our wildlife and game and non-game species. So we wanted to add our support, Mr. Chairman, very briefly and succinctly. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Anyone else who would like to speak for or against this bill, besides Representative Kahn? Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I kind of view this bill as our RIM and CREP in the forested counties. This is a good bill to enhance our forest regeneration, as Mr. Curry said, and to help put some extra foresters into the woods, and it also helps to generate some additional cutting where we need it, where we're at short supply to supply the industry, and I think it'll go a long way to help with assuring the health of the forest, and that's the reason I supported the bill. You know, the district that I am representing, very, very dependent upon timber and harvesting and those practices. Those 10 foresters are like pennies from heaven for us. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Kahn.
I just want to point out, if this is the RIM and CREP, I think both of those are appropriations for
Hampton. Are there other questions?
It's the Rhino.
Are there other questions? Did you want some comment from...
Only if I'm right. I don't want to tell me that I'm wrong. I'll just leave it as a comment thrown at
it. She was asking about the...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I think the question was RIM and CREP, where the funding source is.
Yeah, aren't they accounts in the general fund?
RIM is a large group of programs. I think you've covered for this committee, we're mostly bonding items, so they would be in bonds, but they just paid off in general fund dollars.
All right. The motion, let's see, this is going to be laid over. Okay, this bill will be laid over for inclusion in the omnibus bill. This is just for information of the authors. This is a very good bill. I really appreciate you bringing it to us. I understand it's also a Governor Plenty initiative. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. House Bill 2660 is laid over for inclusion in the omnibus bill. Next House file will be 2790. Morning, Mr. Chair, members. Representative Olson, we'll move House File 2790.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Olson.
I haven't had a chance to explain some things that have happened here, but if it's acceptable to you, I'd like to make some verbal amendments to the bill. We discovered this is a bill that is intended to make this process work better, to assure that everybody who is supposed to pay these fees are in fact paying them. I received some convincing evidence and reports that these fees are not being paid by everyone. And when we drafted the bill, we thought we had it right in simply amending the requirements for the installer to pay the fee to the county. But in fact, the concern is that whichever local unit of government that is the permitting authority is the one that must collect the fee, because the way in which the fee requirements being circumvented is for the installers to have homeowners go buy the tanks and get the permits, and then they never pay the fees in many cases. So the amendment, if I could, Mr. Chair, and if this doesn't fit within your rules, you just gavel me down. The amendment that I'd like to do is to, on line 9, strike an installer and insert the local unit of government. Again, on line 9, strike pay after the word shall and insert the word collect. On line 10, after the word tank, insert to be, the words to be, and put a period after installed and strike the remainder of that line. Delete or strike line 11, line 12, and the word installation on line 13. So that part of the bill reads, the local unit of government shall collect a fee of $25 for each septic system to be installed. Septic system tank to be installed, I'm sorry. And the only other change would be on line 17, to delete the word county and insert local unit of government. And the reason for those changes with regard to installer to local unit of government and county to local unit of government is to reference the permitting authority. And I've checked this with council.
Okay, Representative Olson has made an amendment or a desire to amend, so I'll move his amendment for House Bill 2790. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, this bill gets worse as we go here. When this was originally explained to me last year, it was money collected for four people in the PCA. And also, Mosca told me that this bill was accepted by the installers. When I got home, I got hail from two installers immediately when they found out about it, about the fees. And now it's changed again and adds more fees, so I guess I'm just really questioning the entire bill, 2790, not just the amendment. I pulled back as the author of it last year, and then it reared its head again. And so I don't like the bill. I don't like the fees. And it's, it says local unit government collects. I was wondering, collect from who? There's a number of questions here that I have about the bill.
Let's get the bill in the form that the author desires, and then we'll talk about the merits of the bill. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate those concerns. I'm carrying this because I became convinced that, as I stated, fees are not being paid by everyone under the current process. And when fees are established, they should be done, should be fair and just, justified, and everybody involved that is required to pay them should be paying them. And it's my understanding that under the current system, where an installer is required to pay a fee directly to the commissioner at the end of the year for what the work that they've done, the way in which they're able to get around it under the current system is to simply have homeowners go make certain purchases, and then they just do the excavation work and so forth. And it's been reported to me that they're learning they can get around this by doing that. If we become convinced otherwise, you know, this is a bill I'm presenting to the committee. I'm a sole author on it and trying to make sure this issue gets a hearing. I'm open to changes. I'd like to have you present to the committee the testimony that I've heard from Mosca here. We have the government relations person from Mosca, Mark Hayes. If I could just have some testimony from him. And then I have Steve Skirmers here, also from Mosca.
And welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself to the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, honored committee members. I'm Mark Hayes. I am the
Government Relations Chair for the Minnesota On-Site Sewer Treatment Contractors Association. We are aware that last year we did float this bill initially, and because of the backlash from within the industry, we dropped it. It then again reappeared almost magically and got into the omnibus bill, if I'm correct, and became law. And it didn't take some installers long to try and figure out a way to circumvent paying the fees. We have had cases where tank manufacturers are telling us that they've got all sorts of homeowners coming in and buying tanks nowadays. And the counties are telling us, you know, the inspectors are saying, you know, the homeowners are coming in, a lot more homeowners are coming in and getting those permits and putting down themselves as the installer. And then when we get out there, there's an installer there. And this is all to muddy up the paperwork for proper auditing of this process. Now, the solution I came up with, and many of you know me as somebody who likes coming up with solutions, cockeyed and otherwise, would be to tie this $25 directly to the permit issuance. So who's ever coming to get that septic permit has got to pay the $25 up front. The end of the year, the county count the number of tanks, send it up to whoever cuts the checks for the county, multiply the tank number by 25, sends it to the commissioner. Yeah, to me that makes sense because it eliminates two full steps of paperwork. One, the installer no longer has to worry about how many tanks they installed. Two, the counties do not have to worry about breaking out, you know, installer A did this, B did this, C did that. And therefore, the audit of it at the PCA goes from 1,500 installers to, I'm thinking, around 200 local units of government total. And I'm basing that number on the number of local ordinances there are. So, I mean, it's my attempt is to try to streamline this and get it so that it's a lot easier for everybody. And, you know, just a carrot for the counties, I wanted to give them the opportunity to collect up to a $5, you know, basically I was thinking a origination fee type of thing you have like on your deer license. Now, lines 17, 18, and 19 are not dear to our hearts whatsoever. It was just, you know, a way for the counties to maybe booster their local programs a little bit because they only get $980 from the PCA to begin with, and for ISTS, and say Wright County, if they were to collect the full $5, that would mean they would have around $3,500 extra dollars for that local program, and that could help out the outstate counties even more. But like I said, those three lines are not near and dear to me at all. We can strike those almost immediately.
I understand the sense you're making, but my question goes is a little more basic. We know that a third of the systems in Minnesota are failing. How does this fee help or not help getting going on dealing with those failing systems? Is it related or at all or not?
I cannot speak to the future, of course. As far as I know, this $25 tank fee has gone to hiring regional PCA ISTS professionals for enforcement purposes. Gretchen Sable was here. There she is. She could speak much better to that point than I could. I have no handle on exactly where that money's gone. I know that the PCA has hired some regional ISTS people in the regional offices.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Guinius, that's a very good question. And I don't know all the history on this Environment Fund referenced at line 15, but I suspect that that's looking at what the monies go for in that fund would relate to your answer.
Representative McGinnis.
Well, Mr. Chair, we do need to do some problem solving around the failing septic systems, and I don't know whether this is if the fund is dedicated to working on the failing septic systems. I think that's an important piece of the puzzle.
And we'll get some testimony, I believe, on that. Any additional testimony?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Steve Shermers. I'm also on the Government Relations Committee. I was the chair of our committee last year when the bill was brought to the legislation. And where we were last year is we came in and the vendors were going to actually collect this fee. We were also going to increase our license fees by $100 to help fund the state ISTS program. Along with it, we wanted some money. If we were willing to increase our fee, we were going to have some money from the general fund. Well, that all got dropped, so we dropped the bill, and the tank fee was also under the Minnesota Environmental Partnerships, and that's where it actually ended up falling, going through into the omnibus bill. At the very end, it got transferred to the installers versus the vendors. And my understanding, the way it was explained to me, that then it became a surcharge and not a tax. So we were actually trying to keep it in our own industry and take care of it. But we had less tank installers than we do, or manufacturers, excuse me, versus the installers. So we're trying to keep the cost down of trying to run this program. What we've seen happen now, because where it ended up, through our in January we had our general annual convention, and just speaking with people there, that yes, there are some funds that are not being collected because of just trying to cheat. The homeowners are buying the tanks, and the whole thing with where this fund's going to go is the agency. We had, several years ago, we had 14 people helping run a good program. And as of now, we were down to zero. So this fund was to get back some people to do some enforcement, so we have good installations for the homeowners that are out there. We got a lot of repairs that need to be done, but we've been also having some poor installations. So the training process was supposed to increase. The enforcement process was supposed to increase. Then there's a new technology review that's going to start for new products that are coming into the state to help the homeowners that have problem situations. Then there was also going to be one more place these funds were going to help out. There was a program through several counties that were going to go in and actually help to improve if they elected to get on the program, and funds used to help repair septic systems. The other thing that we're finding, and I had a call from an installer that, you know, he's collecting his fees, and he's up in north of the metro, and he said up there we had, I think he said he had a dozen installers that had just started a business, and they didn't make it, and they ended up filing bankruptcies. And he was upset because he was going to pay these fees, mainly because in a bankruptcy court you can't collect a surcharge. But you can collect the tax. So he says, if they're not going to pay, then I don't want to pay. So there's a big dispute there that the way these funds are out there, that you cannot collect them. Myself, I didn't know if it should go through the LGUs, but it kind of makes sense to go there. You have less people to track as far as individuals' paperwork. And if we have these fees and it takes the agency four people to run the program, that program's going to get eaten up just in salaries. So we're trying to keep it down so we don't have as many people running the program. The LGUs right now have to submit a report to the agency of how many tanks go in, but they do not have to report who put those in. So there's no way right now to track, you know, the individuals without the LGUs going back and getting a good program running. So in this sense, the extra feed would help them, you know, get a computer program where they could start tracking. Because eventually they're going to have to if it stays the way it is. The agency's going to want to know exactly who put the tanks in your community so they can go back and do some enforcement against them if they're not paying it. And that, you know, that's the basic history of this. And you know, there's going to be eventually we'll probably be back here in the future looking for more additional money to get it going, get the program actually a better program. But the contractors association, the installers, the inspectors, I'm an actual designer inspector, are willing to increase their funds, but we also need some additional funds. And hopefully in the future we can get some money through the general fund to help continue this.
No.
Chairman, it's not to the speaker, although maybe it is because we're talking about how fees are collected. The language on line 14 and 15 must be sent to the commission. It doesn't make any sense. We don't do, and it doesn't follow with the next ceremony. We don't do that. That's not a budget term that I'm aware of.
Is there any other testifiers for you, Representative Olson? We have Mr. Warens from Association of County. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my name is David Warens with the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'm here to speak in opposition to House File 2790. In talking with a number of counties about this particular issue, they don't see a lot of merit in having the counties collect this fee. I'll go into some of the reasons why. But certainly my kind of counties, I've heard from over 30 counties who have expressed concern and opposition to this matter of collecting the fee. I think there's been a lot of history of this fee discussed so far this morning testimony already. And AMC did support the fee last year as it was passed and for purpose which has been used to increase the ability of the PCA to actually carry out a program with the previous staff levels of, I believe it was 2.5 full-time equivalents. Obviously, they could not effectively manage a statewide program involving thousands of professional licensed people, over 300 local units of government as well. So it's something that we need to get more capacity within the agency. There was also some funds for some pilot projects that I expect will be announced sometime in the near future. And there was also a slight increase in the grants made to counties as well, from $987 per year to $1,500 per year. So to my understanding, that's where those funds have gone, to increase staffing, pilot projects, and a small increase to the funds provided to counties. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Just a few of the thoughts that counties have had as we have looked at this bill and why we believe it's appropriate to keep it as it currently is we believe it's important to internalize the costs of programs and activities. If the fee is paid to the installer, it will be viewed as part of the cost of the system. If the fee is paid to the county, it's going to be viewed as another county government fee, and that's just the way it's going to be viewed. And I think that's the way things work out already. Certainly, those familiar with in the area of waste management, that's been a key issue for a long time, is to internalize the cost, both government as well as private. We also believe that the installers have a greater capacity to cover their own costs of collecting this as part of doing their line of business. There's not a county I've talked to who believes that $5 per system will cover their costs of doing this. Even if counties could, in fact, increase the fee above what the state is requiring. As I'm sure is no surprise to any of you in this room, with the state fees that were increased last year, most counties increased virtually every fee that they currently have. There is not much capacity out there to increase fees beyond what they currently are based upon last year's experience. I believe it'd be difficult for counties to increase this state fee to cover their costs based upon experiences of the past year. This issue of enforcement, I think, is important, and how the installers are paying the fee. I think if you read the language of the current law, it doesn't matter who buys the septic tank. That's not the issue here. It's who installs the tank is a matter. So if a homeowner buys a tank and gives it to an installer to install, the fee still must be paid. That's my reading of the law, and I think that's important to keep that in mind. Now, we recognize there will be some cases where homeowners will install their own tanks, but there will be a very small minority of people who have both the equipment and the expertise to do the job well. And that was recognized as one issue last session. I would certainly hope as the PCA works on this over the coming years, through enforcement, through the collection, to identify to what extent that really is an issue that needs to be addressed in some fashion. But I think the evidence right now is that it is not known to be an issue of great extent, and does not warrant the change that is proposed in House File 2790. We also know that installers do pay sales tax on the installations. They're familiar with remitting, with collecting and remitting revenue to the state of Minnesota. I don't view this as being any particularly different than what they're doing in that regard as well. The last thing I would suggest is that to the extent there is concern about this fee, and I've heard about it from some counties where they talk to homeowners out there, you know, people are excited about paying fees, that goes without saying. But we do need the service of running an ISTS program. But there are alternatives that could be considered. Putting the fee on manufacturers, we recognize there are some shortcomings there of the potential for buying tanks outside of Minnesota if the fee could put in those circumstances. Another option is to do an add-on to the sales tax that's already being remitted by the installers. Would be another option. But again, of course, we know that runs into the political issue of the fee versus tax issue that that would be a problem, certainly with the administration and probably many members of this body as well. So, Mr. Chairman, Mayor of the committee, those are our thoughts on this. And we would encourage the committee to not move this bill forward, to keep the fee as it currently is, and knowing that as time goes forward, certainly from PCA, counties, and installers, we'll all be keeping track of how this works. And if changes are warranted in the future, we should be expecting to come back and work on fixing those problems. Thank you.
Any questions, Mr. Wyrens? Lupinius.
Thank you. Mr. Wyrens, I think what you're telling us is that the installers are not reading lines 9 and 10 of current law to the way you're reading it. In other words, they're reading it a different way. Now, is it just possible that we could make that language more clear, which is possible. You know, we can always make language more clear. And that, do you believe that that would solve the problem that installers would then pay the money in? I mean, if we, that's just one line, and they think maybe we can get around it. If we put a second sentence in that made it abundantly clear, which is pretty easy to do, do you think that would solve the problem?
Mr. Chair and Representative Guineas, I certainly would agree with you that making it as clear as possible, and if people do believe there is an opportunity to work around current language, that may be warranted. Although even as I say that, I think the current language is pretty clear. But I'm not an attorney, so there may be other ways of reading it beyond what...
Representative Guineas, we'll pursue that a little bit when we get somebody from MPCA here. Because I also agree that there's, I want to find out how they're actually administrating this right now. But, do you have any questions of Mr. Wyrens? Okay, let's see if we get someone from MPCA. I believe Gretchen Sable.
Sable with the Pollution Control Agency. I have a couple things to share about the bill. So I heard questions about what we're doing with the money, and I can talk about that a little bit. I can talk about how collections have been going, and I can talk about our administrative procedures.
I think we're more interested in the, because of the stress of time here, that the how is the money actually collected now, and how do you do it? Because I think we're not questioning as to how you're using the money.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We already have a relationship with all the installers of septic tanks because we license them. And so we know who they are, we know where they live, and they need to interact with us yearly to get their license.
Whoa.
And so,
because of that business relationship, we recognize that that was a doable thing to collect the fee from them. We also know the same for local governments, so you can make that argument on either side. What we've done with the installers is we sent out a letter last June saying that this new tank fee is coming on. We sent them a form to fill out. We sent a follow-up reminder in the fall and then a letter in the winter requesting that they send the money in with the fee. Collections have been good. We've gotten about $334,000, $333,000 for a partial year, so that was probably in line with what we were anticipating. To ensure that we're getting the money, we've requested that local governments provide us a list of installers and how many tanks each installer has put in. We've tied it with counties to getting the money that they get from us. They get $1,500 a year, which isn't a lot, but we've asked that in return for that pittance that they also send us this list of installers. I suspect we're going to have more difficulty with cities and towns, but you know, we're working on that. A number of installers have contacted me. They were concerned in June and July that they'd already issued contracts for these system upgrades and that they hadn't built in the fee. And so there was a lot of problems in the early summer with those contracts that spanned the date, and a number of contractors said they would just pay it because they didn't want to go back to their clients. And so that was a problem. But since then, people seem to have been paying. And so now what we've done now, we're starting to send out the 2004 license registrations, and we've sent out again the form with their license registration saying, reminding them that as installers, they need to collect this fee and send it in. And it seems like we're getting, you know, like I said, collections are fairly on target with what we expected, and so it seems like a system that can and does work. I did a fiscal note, too. It's available for you. There would be no fiscal impact to the state, although we did note that there may be some fiscal impact to local governments.
Questions? Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Abel, how many licensed installers are there in the state right now?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish, I would have said 1,400. They said 1,500. I suspect the number is in between there.
Thank you, Representative Wiginius.
When you write your letter to the installers, do you make it abundantly clear to them to say, even if your homeowner purchases the tank, you must pay the fee? In other words, lay it out very clearly to them that they understand that that's what is expected. I mean, is that line in your letter in bold?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wiginius, that line isn't in the letter in bold, but we do make it clear that it's the person that installs the tank. And so we've had a number of things. On our website, you'll find a, I think we call it frequently asked questions that goes into that in more detail, and we sent that out. So, you know, it talks about, we've seen a number of interesting ways that people collect the fee. We do have one installer, every time he installs a system, he has the homeowner write us a check for $25, and he mails those in. And so we're finding different ways that people are complying as well as not complying. And as we find non-compliance, we try to address it.
I was going to ask with regard to the language that's written. The design of a system can be different, and if they'd have a tank that has multiple chambers mm-hmm. versus if they put in separate tanks. The way it's written, it says $25 per tank. And it's if you have multiple chambers, is that's one tank, that's $25. If you put in separate tanks, are you charging them $25 for each tank?
Mr. Chair, that's the language of the law as written, so yeah, we were.
Is there a reason that we didn't say the systems, a septic tank system?
Mr. Chair, I don't know exactly why we said what we said.
Okay.
It says what it says.
It just seems to me that that's an inequity that, depending upon how the tank is actually designed mm-hmm. and how the installer chooses to put them in, we then end up with a fee that
Chair,
doesn't
if you were to change
have any logic to it.
To go to a per system fee, right now I believe that probably 20% of the systems that go in have more than one tank, and so it would affect the bottom line fairly significantly.
Very confusing. I think that we issued needs to be looked into more. I don't know that we have enough information to really come to a conclusion this year, but I think that we might give you some direction to help sort this out and maybe put in something that can actually collect the dollars. It's a user fee that we're really trying to get to, because that's what the money is going for, is to try and help maintain the professionalism out there with regard to the installation of these systems. And but make it the collection in such a way that it is a little more fair, and it's towards the system and not necessarily how the system is designed. I mean, if a system's designed with three tanks, they get $75. If they design it in a different way, put it all in one container, essentially accomplishing the same thing, they only get $25. That's a flaw I think we need to address. Representative Wiginius?
We'd agree with you, Mr. Chairman, that that's a flaw that should be addressed. We don't want the fee to make people design a system one way instead of another way, so I would agree with that. But I would also say that it seems to me that in the correspondence, directly, you must say to people, to the installers, if a homeowner pays, you know, goes and buys, that doesn't count. You have to say it clearly. If the problem has been identified, address it clearly. Because sometimes that is the issue right there, that people think if we're not clear enough in the way we talk to people. Mm-hmm. And it feels to me that there's some lack of clarity because the installers think they can get around it. So obviously they think there's a lack of clarity and they can get around it.
Yeah, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I really do want to thank the attentiveness of everyone here to let us air this issue and concern. I know we heard from Mr. Warens with the counties that this isn't a good time for any fee increases. I was apprehensive to carry the bill with that concern. There's a lot of pressure like that out there. But airing this issue, I think, is important, and I'd like to make that point by asking a question of Gretchen Sable here with the MPCA. The question being, is it, under the current system, is it possible for installers to get around this fee through the means in which it's been reported, by the way it's been reported, is it possible for them to get around the fee by the way it's been reported, by letting homeowners purchase tanks and then just not pay the fee themselves? And can that be caught without audits?
Mr. Chair and Representative Olson, we are auditing. We're beginning the process of auditing now. We had a number of installers that reported zero installations, and so we're going to be talking with them to find out, you know, why they bought a license then and what that was about. I think that people find any number of ways to circumvent any system that you put in. So if it were a system tied to permitting, then they would find ways to not get a permit. If it were a system tied to other things, we have people that work without licenses now and things like that as well. And so by us being able to use the money to put into building a stronger regulatory system, we'll actually be able to catch more of them. And so I think that the answer is that yes, people get around it now. They'll find other ways to get around whatever else.
Mr. Chair, thank you, because that really makes my point. I think the system we're advocating for is one that would truly get the fees collected. We wouldn't have to have all this regulatory environment to assure that it gets collected, because you don't get a permit without paying a fee under the bill that we're proposing. So we wouldn't have all this added cost to enforce. It just simply works better. Now, this may not, it isn't the best environment for dealing with fees right now, and I understand that. And each member has to weigh out their basis for voting. But again, I want to thank the committee for taking time to look at this. The better we can structure the processes so that we don't have to regulate and audit and do all these different things that just add cost, the more likely we will be able to one day lower the fees or keep them at this level for a much longer period of time. And I think that's an important factor to consider. So I'd appreciate members' consideration, and thanks again for the time.
You're welcome. I think we'll be laying House File 2790 open for further discussion. Okay, any other questions from members?
Thank
you. We are adjourned. Thank you very much.